Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
All right, that said, Alvin, if you don't mind, can you start me off with a little music for this next take, for the opening take? If you spent the entire weekend bumping that, I feel you. Arguably the greatest intro to anything ever. Don't at me at that. Don't at me about that. It is that good. If you're debating all-time great intros, the only debate then is which version was better. The old-school Chicago Stadium version or the slightly updated version when they moved to the new building and they had those computer graphics of the Bulls running through the streets. You never need a reason to revisit those intros, but last night provided the perfect reason to do so because The Last Dance finally dropped. The Last Dance started last night, and that doc, the first two episodes of it, had a lot of what you'd expect. Michael and Scotty, a little Dennis, some Phil, but as good as the two episodes were, and believe me, in the absence of anything else in sports, they were excellent. You know, they didn't tell us too much of what we didn't already know, but in the absence of anything else, they were still great. Except there is one thing that we didn't know that I'm glad they brought up, and they got to it pretty early. The fact that the Bulls were a, quote, traveling cocaine circus. It's an amazing line. A traveling cocaine circus. Something even better when you consider how funny Mike thought it was when they dropped that on him. Something he apparently had not heard before.
One of the articles I read, they called it the Bulls Traveling Cocaine Circus.
I never read that article.
Accurate?
Let's not get into that just yet. That's like the funniest thing Mike ever heard. Hey, Mike, what do you make of the fact that you guys were a traveling cocaine circus?
One of the articles I read, they called it the Bulls Traveling Cocaine Circus.
I never read that article.
Accurate?
Traveling Cocaine Circus. Man, that is such an awesome description. And now it's about to be used in about a billion fantasy team names. And there was another surprise. I thought from episode number one, there was a whole lot of Crumbs Krause. That's something I did not expect to see so early in the doc. I mean, you knew that'd be a factor, to be sure, but I did not expect to see Krause trending on Twitter as early as he did last night. But man, the GM was taking some in that first episode. In fact, he took a hell of a lot. He was getting it on all sides. The fact that the players and Phil really didn't like that guy is nothing new. But I didn't think that we were going to get to that as quickly as we did. And the venom and the vitriol were fierce. Personal appearance may not be show fodder here, but it was there as MJ lit into Krause with fat jokes and short jokes and all in the same joke. It was kind of hard to decipher. Let me help you out with that. That was Michael Jordan talking to the GM of the Bulls and saying, quote, "So, those are the pills to keep you short. Or are those diet pills?" In other words, you're fat and you're short. And are those the pills you take for both those things? Are those the pills to keep you short or are those diet pills? Once more, Alvin, just because. Are those the pills to keep you short or are those diet pills? In other words, you're short and you're fat.
Fat?
That's a player saying that to a GM. MJ was going in on Krause as hard as he went in on his teammates. And that was pretty bleeping hard as well.
Talk.
Again, the audio is kind of hard to decipher. That's him going in on his teammates at practice. No video yet of anybody getting punched by Mike, but that's Mike going in verbally. But to me, the take-home message from early on in the episode or in the doc was how much these guys hated Jerry Krause. And the way it shows up in that doc, you can see why. I mean, first thing first, and this needs to be acknowledged right off the top, the guy did deserve a hell of a lot of credit for assembling the roster that he did. Krause deserved credit for surrounding Jordan with guys like Pippen, Rodman, Harper, Kukoc, Kerr, and more. He deserved credit for bringing in Phil Jackson as the head coach, the perfect guy to manage that roster. That was not an easy team to coach. That was a ridiculous roster that Krause put together, period. So there's that. I want to acknowledge that. But the only thing more ridiculous than the roster that he put together is the idea that they would actually think about blowing it up after winning two straight titles. And that sure seemed like that was the plan. And what the hell kind of plan is that? How unfathomable is it that they were actually considering not letting these guys defend their back-to-back titles? You have the chance to make history, and yet there was Krause looking to blow the entire thing up. And team owner Jerry Reinsdorf seemed pretty much fine with the whole thing. And again, it wasn't just the players beefing with Krause. It was Phil Jackson, too. And Jackson managed to get on the wrong side of Krause after pushing back on what Krause was offering him in a contract. And even more importantly, because Krause saw Jackson as somebody else who was getting credit that Krause himself thought that he deserved. So, Krause was looking to break this guy off even after he won five rings. Five rings. I mean, like, I get that Phil Jackson was a pretty arrogant guy. I get that Jackson was not the easiest guy to get along with. But he did just win you five titles. And despite that fact, you were thinking about not bringing this guy back for another. How insane is that? Like, he was looking to run off a guy that had won five championship rings. Jerry Jones saying that he could win a Super Bowl with 500 other coaches besides Jimmy Johnson cannot believe how jacked up that thinking is. Well, truthfully, Jerry did win another Super Bowl with another coach. Nothing since, but he did get one more. Krause, on the other hand, was not just looking to run off a five-time champ, but he was actively and publicly recruiting and grooming Iowa State's Tim Floyd to be the next coach. All the while, he still had a Hall of Fame coach as his head coach and a guy that his superstar, GOAT, said that he wanted to play for and had to. Tim Floyd. Not Pat Riley, mind you. Tim freaking Floyd. And you want to know how Jack Krause was in his own head, how far off the reservation this guy had wandered, then look no further than this story. He invited everyone who was anyone to his stepdaughter's wedding, including Floyd, but not Phil Jackson. That actually happened. That is incredible. That is brass as hell and reckless as hell and dumb as hell. I do have a question. Exactly where was Reinsdorf in all of this? I mean, sure, he had that crack about how somebody should be relieved not to get an invite to a wedding. But exactly where was the owner in all of this? Why didn't the owner step in before it got to all of this? Who takes the GM side over Jordan's side in this? Because that's what Reinsdorf did. Because Jordan had already made it clear he wouldn't play for anybody other than Phil Jackson. He actually said that. Yet there was Krause calling Phil into his office and telling Jackson it would be his final year after he'd won five titles, telling him he could go effing 82-0 and still wouldn't be allowed back. So why was Reinsdorf siding with the guy who told Phil he could go 82-0 and still would not be allowed to come back? What kind of an idiotic plan is that? Is that like some kind of weird motivational crap? Or was he trying to be cute with it because he knew the guys hated Krause and nothing would unite his team and the coaching staff more than their collective hatred of Krause? Or finally, did he actually think that was a good idea and that that was the plan he really wanted to go with and that Krause was more important to the organization than his Hall of Fame coach and his Hall of Fame player? Oh, and speaking of that plan, the whole plan that Krause was cooking up seemed dumb as hell. Was his take really that guys not named Jordan were getting old, so he wanted to get rid of everybody and rebuild around Jordan? And was it because he didn't want them to age out? And it's always better to get rid of guys a little bit too early as opposed to holding on to them a little bit too long, a la the hoodie in New England. Or was Krause looking to get rid of everybody not named Jordan because he thought everybody not named Krause was not getting the credit for the dynasty? And he got sick of it and wanted to get his. Because that notion that they were old, busted up, and falling apart is garbage. Pippen, Kukoc, Longley, and Kerr were all younger than Jordan. And if the idea was that guys were getting worn out because of the long playoff runs, I get that. But the solution should not have been to pack C4 around the roster and just blow it up. What? You're just going to roll out there with Jordan, Jason Caffey, Dickie Simpkins, Rusty LaRue, and expect them to compete for titles. And then slap them all together with Tim Floyd and win a ring. And then everybody would know that Jerry Krause was the real reason that they had all the rings. If anybody should have known how hard it was to win a title or even to be a good team, it should have been anybody associated with the Bulls at that time. Because, as we go to break, I would say they'd gone from being the traveling cocaine circus to a dynasty. But not because of some magical spell. I mean, sure, in part because of the so-called short, fat guy who picked the players and the coach, but not because of him. They were a dynasty because they had three Hall of Fame players, arguably the greatest European player of all time, and a Hall of Fame coach. But there was Krause thinking they could blow it up and retool, and the owner was okay with that. And get the hell out of here with it. Not only did they think they could retool, but there was genuinely even a debate as to whether or not they'd get to defend their second straight title. Krause deserves a ton of credit for what he did in assembling that roster. Credit. But it was idiotic to try to blow it up or think about blowing it up before they were done. Credit for six, no credit for trying to blow it up. 1-800-636-8686. A lot more where that came from. And that was already a lot off the top. Jerry Krause getting a lot of run and all of it bad early and often. Some other things I want to get into as it relates to episode number two. Well, end up one. Mike's glass. I tweeted last night, Mike ain't playing with that pour. I mean, it's one thing, right, to have a pop before an interview. He's not the first, allegedly, whatever was in that glass. He wouldn't be the first. He certainly won't be the last. But I'm not sure I've ever seen anybody rock that kind of pour during an interview. And to watch it go up and down was mesmerizing. That was absolutely incredible. Capital One knows life does not alert you about your credit card. That's why we created Eno, the Capital One assistant that catches things that might look wrong with your credit card, like overtipping, duplicate charges, or potential fraud. It then sends an alert to your phone and helps you fix it. Also, use Eno to get virtual card numbers to better protect yourself when you shop online. It's another way that Capital One is watching out for your money when you're not. Capital One, what's in your wallet? See CapitalOne.com for details. Bobby in Des Moines. Hey, Bobby, how are you?
Jim, I'm great. Jim, first time, long time. Thanks so much. It's a privilege to be on with you. I'm calling about the Dexy Midnight Runner herself, that one-hit wonder Jeff in Southfield, or as I like to call him by his acronym, the J-I-S, a.k.a. the Jizz, which works well due to the fact
that... That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
I guess Alvin's not having it. Not with that acronym. Bobby in Des Moines, talking about Jeff in Southfield as, well, the thing that just got him run. Anybody else? Let's try El Centro, Brent. Good to have you, Brent. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Jim. So I want to talk about this comparison between LeBron and MJ. And the thing is, when MJ was playing, the scores were in the 80s and 90s, and nowadays they're in the 120s, 130s, 140s. So I think if MJ was playing today, he'd be averaging 40 or 45. And the thing about the assists, MJ knew he was the best man to shoot. That's why he didn't have a bunch of assists, because he knew he was the one that needed to shoot the ball.
You know, okay, Brent, thanks very much. He's bringing up the question about, all right, then, so who is it? Is it Mike or LeBron? My man, Dan. Dan on a Monday. What's going on, Dan? How was your weekend? How you feeling?
Homie, I'm tired, man. I'm going to tell you that right now. I mean, but you got the pipes of an angel, the lettuce for the big screen. You're looking good. I'm actually watching you, got you on mute, but I'll tell you why I'm tired though. So, you know, I got a 4-month-old at home. He's whining, crying, you know, every 3 hours, which is what a baby does. Well, I finally get him down at 1 a.m. You know, it's like, it's night time. Let's go to bed. I look out the window and I just hear howling like a wolf at a moon, man. And it's a guy who's ripping a dart. He's letting his dog out at 1 a.m. just barking. Wakes up my 3-month-old or 4-month-old, and now I'm up for 2 more hours. Okay, so let's go fast forward to like 8 o'clock this morning. I'm walking the dog. You know, it's all nice. I turn the corner, and there it is. The freaking trash can, man. Pickup was Friday. And then I think to myself, this is the same guy who had his dog out at 1 a.m. ripping darts and checking his phone. I'm like, bring that dog in and don't wake up my child again. Thanks, Romy.
Rack him. I don't know why it is. This guy and his shtick about the a-hole neighbor who will not bring his trash cans in makes me laugh every single time. Let's go to Chapel Hill. Jeff in Chapel Hill. Good to have you, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How about yourself?
Great. Really good.
Hey, that was probably a really nice old scotch in his glass because the guy that signed Michael to his first Gatorade contract was a guy by the name of Bill Schmidt, who was the bronze medalist in the 72 Olympics in the javelin, who was working with Gatorade, and he had a taste for fine scotch and fine cigars, and I'm sure he sealed the deal with Mike with those. But anyway, I wanted to throw something out, a different take on The Last Dance for you to think about.
Yes.
What university turned out two kind of game changers the way UNC did with Michael in basketball and LT in football? And those guys even overlapped. LT's last year was Michael's first year here in Chapel Hill.
That's actually an interesting question right there. So you got what university turned out a couple of guys who were that dominant, that iconic? North Carolina, LT and Michael Jordan. We are joined by Harrison Barnes. Harrison, it's been a minute or so. It's great to have you back on the program. First things first, how are you and your family doing in the middle of all of this, Harrison?
Jim, glad to be back on. This time has been different. It's been good to be at home with my wife, spend some more time there. But, you know, obviously what's going on in the world, it's crazy. So definitely trying to help where we can and get as much information as we can.
Now, let's talk about that for a minute, and we'll talk basketball, Harrison, shortly. But you and your wife, Brittany, have been donating to fund weekly groceries for vulnerable families and seniors at this time. And today you're covering coffee and pastries for physicians and staff working at the South Sacramento Medical Center ICU. What does it mean then to both of you to be able to be in a position to give back like this?
The game of basketball has been extremely fortunate, you know, to me. And, you know, when a pandemic like this happens and so many people are, you know, in need, we're just trying to do our part to help where we can. And, you know, Sierra Health is doing unbelievable things. So we definitely want to partner up with them to try to do our part.
We're talking to Harrison Barnes. You know, I'm curious, how much of your desire to give back maybe comes from your mother, Shirley, and her approach to giving back?
Man, actually a lot of it comes from her. You know, just seeing when I was younger, you know, her, you know, be involved with, you know, nonprofits and giving back and just always having, you know, really a generous heart. That left an impression on me that if I ever had a chance or the opportunity to do the same, I would try to do that to the best of my ability. So that's what I try to do.
In fact, from a very young age, right? Like when you and your sister were young, your mother started an organization called Suited for Work Clothing Closet. What did that organization do? And then what kind of an example did that have on you and your sister?
Yeah, so pretty much, you know, it allowed, if you were unemployed and you were going in for a job interview, it allowed you to go and get like a clothes for that interview. And then if you got the job, you got a few more clothes. And, you know, my sister and I would be there with my mom and we would like change out the clothes for the different seasons and all this stuff. And I'm looking like, you know, we're giving a lot to a lot of other people. I mean, we would love some of these clothes ourselves. But you know, I think just seeing the reactions of people that came in there and were impacted by that was huge. And you just saw that, you know, one person's sacrifice can really make a difference in someone else's life.
Harrison Barnes joining us. All right, so how have you been spending your time since the season was suspended? And what's a normal day like for you now?
Man, I've been trying to dabble in a few different things. Reading more, working on my putting and chipping game out in the yard, you know, watching a lot of TV shows. Typically in the mornings, you know, I'll do my lift at the house, work out there, and then the rest of the day is kind of up in the air. So definitely just trying to, you know, stay engaged, stay motivated. Obviously watch a lot of news, but just do different things.
Talking to Harrison Barnes. So I'm curious, what are you reading these days?
So I'm reading a book right now called Barracoon, a book by Zora Neale Hurston, about one of the last slaves that was taken from Africa to the States. And she was able to interview him. And then after she passed away, the book was published about their conversations.
Hmm. Harrison Barnes joining us. You know, from a basketball standpoint, then, what's it like to go from a situation where the team was putting things together and you're making a run at a playoff spot to suddenly having no basketball at all? How do you explain that? What's that feel like?
It's tough. You know, we were plagued with so many injuries this year on our team, and, you know, we kind of finally found a little rhythm there. But, you know, when the games were canceled that last night, we realized it was so much bigger than just us, bigger than the game of basketball, the NBA. So, you know, we definitely want to take our time to, you know, make sure we're doing everything necessary. We're doing our part to flatten the curve. And if we're able to resume this season, that would be great. But if not, we know that that's the best for everyone.
Sacramento King, Harrison Barnes, my guest. You know, you were 13-7 since late January, so you had started to turn things around. Was it just a matter of getting healthy? Because as you point out, there were a lot of injuries. Or what was the biggest change for the team over that stretch?
I think it was having stability. I mean, we had, you know, two starters go down within the first five games. You know, we had a lot of guys playing in a lot of different positions, working guys back from injuries. So it was just a really tough place for us to kind of get our rhythm going. And, you know, we feel like we have a lot of talent in this locker room, so we want to try to, you know, get that chemistry going, and we finally did toward the end of the season.
Yeah, so as that locker room goes, I'm not there, but it seems from the outside looking in, you are now that guy that other players are looking to. You're a guy who leads from the front. So how do you go about staying connected with your teammates and supporting them during this time?
I mean, just trying to stay in touch. You know, everyone's got a different, you know, mindset, different interests, things like that. So just trying to engage with guys, you know, hear about what they're doing, but most importantly, just stay in communication, just talking, whatever it may be, whether it's basketball, whether it's music, whether it's lifestyle stuff, dogs, kids, whatever it is, just trying to stay engaged.
Harrison Barnes joining us for a few more moments. You know, when you talk about leadership, though, I'm looking at your career, and you've played with guys who all had different styles of leadership, guys who led in different ways. You know, guys like Steph, Dirk, Andre Iguodala. What did you learn from each of them in terms of their approach to leadership?
Man, you know, there's a lot of similarities between Dirk and Steph. Just in fact that they lead by example, you know, their game, their work ethic, how they approach every single day, every single practice, every single drill. I think there's something to be said about that. You know, they don't become the great players they are, the great shooters they are, by, you know, taking shortcuts or not going through things at 100%. So, you know, I think from those guys, I've learned leading by example. And then, you know, somebody like Andre, I think I've learned a lot just from his voice. You know, he was always the guy who could fill in the gaps. He could do everything on the floor, you know, at any given time. And I think he was always great at using his voice at opportune moments that really had an impact on our team.
Now, I mentioned off the very top, you're an Olympic gold medalist, and you represented the U.S. at the World Cup last summer. You know, like, I know the results were not what you would have liked, but what did you take away from those international experiences?
Man, I mean, I think, you know, in the game of basketball, you gotta play every game, and it was definitely a tale of two parts of the World Cup. You know, we you know, played some games, and we did well for the first half, and then, you know, when we got to that France game and things kind of fell apart. I think, you know, it was one half that kind of really set the course for us. And I think you just have to be ready to just adapt and adjust. And in that game particularly, we didn't.
Harrison, one thing about your mom before I let you go. The story goes that she was an enormous Michael Jordan fan. What was it? I mean, Mike's Mike. We all love Michael Jordan. But what was it about Jordan that your mother loved so much?
you know, I think, like everyone else saw last night, who you know, was watching Last Dance, I think just his game was poetry in motion. And I think that's what captivated so many fans, her included, to just want to know more about the game of basketball, want to follow the Bulls, want to follow him. And that's what led her to record the games and to then, you know, show them to me and things like that. And that inspired a lot of my love for the game was watching those tapes. So I think just how he approached the game, how he attacked every single day, that was what was so inspiring.
I mean, maybe like last night there wasn't a whole lot that we didn't already know, but as somebody who plays the game at a really high level right now, somebody who knows the game, what were your thoughts watching Jordan and watching The Last Dance last night?
Oh, I was pissed there's only two episodes. I wanted to keep watching just because, you know, the game back then, you know, guys just competed. I mean, you look at the way guys played and those teams, there were so many great teams. And as a professional player now, it makes me miss being on the court. But you just have such an appreciation for those guys because they laid the groundwork for what the game is today. And the ability and the platform that we have as players comes from those guys before us.
Harrison, business is business, and Scottie Pippen laid out why he signed that contract. But when you look at a guy with that skill set, a guy who had that kind of career, and you see the contract that he played under, 7 years, $18 million, even in like in 90s dollars, what do you think when you see those numbers?
Man, that is I was crazy. I mean, when they're clearly on the tape saying that Scottie's the number two player in the league at that time, and he's the sixth highest paid player on his team, you know, it was travesty. And, yeah, I'm looking forward to how they continue to go into that story and the more episodes to continue.
Now more than ever, we know that businesses are grappling with incredibly challenging times. A lot of things in life and business are changing right now, and we are all adapting to our new priorities. While it does take time to adjust, LinkedIn believes that we can create opportunity when our community comes together. Whether you're looking to hire now for a critical role or you're thinking about needs that you may have in the future, LinkedIn Jobs is here to help. LinkedIn is an active community with over 675 million members worldwide. LinkedIn screens candidates for the hard and soft skills that you are looking for and puts your job in front of candidates looking for job opportunities like yours. And with LinkedIn, you can hire the right person quickly when you need to. So when it's time to hire and find that right person, LinkedIn is here to help. If you need to hire for healthcare or essential services, you can also post your jobs for free. Just visit LinkedIn.com/Rome. Again, LinkedIn.com/ROME and post a job right now. Terms and conditions do apply. Alex Highsmith is my guest. Alex, you've got an amazing story, which I want to get into. But before we do that, how are you and the people around you doing during this pandemic?
Oh, so just, you know, first I want to say thank you for having me on, Jim. So I've been here in Wilmington the past month, so I've been back home. I know it's been good to be able to spend time with family and everything. So, you know, I found good places to train and good places, you know, to work out. So it's been good, but it's definitely a weird time we're in. You know, it's you know, I know everyone's going through this, and we've never been through anything like this before. So, but you know, I really know we're going to come out stronger from this. So I just encourage everyone to continue to stay safe and just know, yeah. So I just know that I'm working out and I'm staying in shape, and so I'm just ready for this week, so it's exciting.
Well said. Alex Highsmith, my guest. And I appreciate you coming on, Alex. Thanks so much. Now, we're just a few days away from you hearing your name called at the draft, but you touched on this, so let me just follow up. What's it been like to continue to train and then meet with teams via FaceTime and video conference calls instead of actually sitting down face-to-face, because that is really different?
Yeah, it's definitely different. You know, over the past 4 weeks, you know, just doing the FaceTime and Zoom calls with teams, you know, probably talked to and met with, you know, almost half the teams in the league. So, you know, it's been pretty cool. It's definitely different, but, you know, it's still good to be able to take advantage, you know, of technology and be able to call coaches and, you know, talk to some head coaches and stuff like that too. So, you know, it's been good, but just like I said, I'm super excited for, you know, later this week, and I can't wait to see where I end up.
Hey, Alex, I'm curious, what's it like? Like, when you sit down for a Zoom call, do you treat that thing like any other job interview, and do you get dressed up for the part, or are you pretty much just going to go with whatever you're wearing at that time? I mean, do you bring that same level of intensity to it?
I mean, most of my interviews, I've worn, you know, one of my 49er polo shirts, so I try to, you know, look as good as possible. You know, my hair didn't look too good, you know, because I couldn't really find a place to get a haircut
right.
The past month. I just got one, but you know, I just really, you know, I try to take each one of them like a job interview. I know that, you know, how important they are. And so I just came into them with the same mindset that I had with them in the combine.
Alex Highsmith, getting ready for the draft. Now, I ran down part of your resume at the top of the interview, but that's only part of the story. If we were to go back to when you were playing high school football at Ashley High in Wilmington, the story goes you were a little over 200 pounds and playing linebacker at that time. So what were you like as a player at that point?
So at that time, you know, like you said, I was just over 200 pounds. So I was like taller and skinny, but I played inside back. We ran a 3-3 stack, so I was a Mike backer. So, you know, before I got to college, I've never really passed rush before. You know, I feel like, you know, that's what hurt me, you know, with getting off, with not being able to get any offers really because of my size. But, you know, it's definitely funny, you know, going back and watching my film and seeing, you know, how skinny I was back then and how I played that middle backer spot.
I mean, the story is amazing, right? Like, you were not getting a lot of attention, as you point out, from schools. And then you played Haggard High School, who was coached by Scott Braswell. His son was a graduate assistant at Charlotte at that time. And you asked Scott Braswell if there was any chance he could pass your film on to his son and the staff at Charlotte. What inspired you to do that? And then what happened next?
You know, Charlotte was the place that I wanted to go. So, you know, I feel like that's what inspired me to do that. You know, besides Charlotte, my other interest, you know, teams that are looking at me were Furman and Davidson, and Furman, you know, a private school in South Carolina, the SCS school. I really enjoyed my visit there, but, you know, they offered me a partial scholarship. You know, I still would have been paying more out of state to go there than if I would have gone to Charlotte. So, you really just, I remember the first time I went to Charlotte is actually after I visited Davidson for a junior day. I went there and just fell in love with the campus, you know, just the idea of being part of a startup program was something, you know, that just really intrigued me, you know, just getting there, you know, I wanted to leave the place better than I found it. And so, you know, it's just pretty cool that I had that connection with Coach Braswell and his son. So, I'm just glad they gave me a chance and made the most of it.
All right. So you loved it there and then they invited you to walk on. What was it like when you received that news?
Oh, it was pretty cool. So actually, I didn't know I was going to be team until like June, right before I came. So I gone to orientation and stuff like that. And actually, I went to orientation after I found out. But at first, I was rooming with some of my best friends from high school. And then I remember it was in June. I didn't know it was going to be the team at the time. I went on a couple of visits. I went to a spring practice in the spring game. And then I remember June, I got an email saying my dorm's been switched to the football dorm. So that's kind of when I found out. You know, I didn't make the initial 105, but I went came the first day of school, you know, just made the most of my opportunity.
Alex Highsmith joining us. So that had to be really cool. And then you just start to go to work and you put the work in. And then in 2017, you were awarded a scholarship. What did it mean to see that hard work pay off the way it did?
It meant so much, you know, just how much God's grace and my hard work has got me in my life. You know, it's just so amazing to see. And, you know, I remember that day. I remember Coach Lambert called me into his office. And I was actually heading home that day because I didn't know, because I wasn't planning on coming back for summer workouts, you know, if I didn't get a scholarship because I didn't want my parents to have to pay for school. So I remember he called me in his office, told me his scholarship, you know, I looked at this guy, said, and thank you, Jesus, and thank you for just everything, you know, that I've been blessed with. And I was just almost like, I didn't cry in front of him, but I was starting to. And then I remember I told all my boys and I told all my teammates and, I remember I was going to home to see my family that day since I was going home. So I waited to tell them until I saw them face-to-face at my house. I remember how much joy they had when I told them I got a scholarship. But, you know, that wasn't the end-all, be-all goal for me. That was just something to springboard me to do bigger and better things.
Still, that must have been such an amazing moment to come home and share that with your family. So you kind of lead me to my next point, Alex. Like, at that point, when you get that scholarship, so you got a spot, then you got a scholarship. Were you thinking about the NFL at that point, or were you focused on just making an impact on your team?
You know, the NFL, you know, definitely wasn't in my mind, you know. But, you know, at the same time, it was more focused on making an impact on my team. And something that I really learned over the past 3 years, you know, my goals have always been in my mind, but something I've learned, you know, is to truly fall in love with the process, to not worry about the results and just, you know, to do the little things right day to day, week to week, month to month, and let the results handle themselves. So, yes, the NFL is definitely still a dream of mine. It's definitely something I still was aiming for, but, you know, really that year was something, you know, that I was trying to make as much of an impact on my team that year. And so and the next year I ended up earning a starting spot in 2018, and that's, you know, really when the NFL started becoming reality for me.
I want to ask about 2018 before you go. That was an amazing year because you broke out in a huge way. You set a school record for 17 and a half tackles for loss. You were a first team all conference selection. So what was that season like for you?
It was great. You know, it was a heck of a season. You know, we were so close to making a bowl game. I really feel like we should have that year, but, you know, we were such a great defense that year. You know, I didn't play defensive in that year. I played a 4-I. And, you know, I feel like, you know, what made us such a good defense is everyone sacrificed something. You know, My original position was a defensive end and ended up playing 4-I. You know, well, our other defensive end ended up playing middle backer in our scheme. But, you know, it was a scheme that ended up working because, you know, we had an amazing defensive coach in Glenn Spencer, who's now at South Florida. And so it was just an amazing year. I still remember the game we played Tennessee, and, you know, we had one of our best defensive games of the year against them. And so it was just an awesome year. And so I was just glad to be able to have a breakout year that year.
Talking to Alex Highsmith for a couple of minutes. You know, I've had your head coach, Will Healy, on the program. I love the energy that he brings to it and the atmosphere that you guys all created in Club Lit. What was it like to play for him?
It was awesome. You know, I still remember the first meeting he came. His introductory press conference day, he came and he just started clapping it up in the meeting. And, you know, we were kind of like caught off guard. And, but he just, the energy that he brings to that program is so awesome. You know, he always preaches on passion, energy, enthusiasm, and positivity. And so, you know, that's something that has been instilled in me, you know, especially this past year. You know, no matter what's going on, how the season's going, you know, I'm still going to be the same person. That's what I've been preaching to teams. You know, I'm still going to have the same work ethic and bring the same energy every single day. And I still remember the very first Club Lit when we beat Gardner Webb, and he came in and took his shirt off and started jumping and dancing. I was like, yo, this is crazy. So, but it was awesome. And, you know, just thankful for everything that, you know, Coach Healy's done for me and just our whole program. And, you know, Charlotte's in amazing hands with him and the rest of their staff, for
sure. It's so funny, right when you mentioned that you said that he came in, he was clapping it up. We rolled some video here on the CBS Sports Network, and the video, of course, is him clapping it up, just clapping it up, bringing the energy, bringing the passion. And in addition to all of this, Alex, as some people know, you're a child actor, and you appeared in Dawson's Creek. Now, when I say child actor, you appeared on the show as a baby. How much pride is there for you in knowing that you have an acting credit to your name?
It's pretty cool. You know, that's really, you know, a family secret of ours, and it's kind of gotten out.
Not anymore, it's not, my man.
Not anymore, it's not. People are starting to find out about it now, but, you know, it is pretty cool. You know, look back, we still have the season one in my house, and so I'm probably going to try to watch it this week, and I wonder if they're going to pull it up on draft day or something like that. It'd be pretty cool. But yeah. It's cool to look back and see, you know, that I was a baby actor, and I had, like, three scenes of me crying, so... It was pretty cool to see, for sure.
That's awesome. All right, so after everything you have been through, starting with your career as a baby actor and grinding it out, walking on, getting a scholarship, becoming an all-conference player, and getting all this notoriety, do you have any idea what it's going to feel like when you get that call and you know you're going to be playing in the NFL?
I already know what it's going to be like. I already know that I'm going to be emotional. I'm not going to cry right away, but you know, when that happens, I'm going to be emotional and I see my mom, she's going to be really emotional, so that's when I'm going to start getting emotional as well. And so it's going to be awesome. You know, I'm going to, you know, have my parents there, my girlfriend there, my best friends there, and so my sister will be there as well. So, it's, you know, I plan on having a lot more people, but, you know, it's going to be awesome, you know, to have the people that I love the most there.
It's going to be amazing. NFL draft gets underway on Thursday night. He's a former Charlotte edge rusher, named to the 2020 NFL All-Combine team as an edge rusher and All-American as well. Alex Highsmith. Alex, great to have you on. Thanks so much. Good luck this week with the draft, and I'm really curious to see where you end up.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Jim. Thank you for having me. Have a good one.
It is Stoner Christmas, and I want to acknowledge that for the first time ever in its illustrious 124-year history, as an example. The Boston Marathon is not going off today as scheduled. And that's obviously because every event involving more than 10 people is currently on pause while the globe works together to stop the spread of the coronavirus. Every event is on hold, except for one. Because while the world may have stopped spinning, it sure as hell has not stopped smoking. To which I say, Merry Stoner Christmas Heads. Happy 420. And your highest of the high holidays is finally here. And nothing can stop it, not even this pandemic. And while there may not be a marathon today, there is a worldwide smoke-a-thon to honor the Waldos and their secret three-digit code for sneaking off to get lifted back in 1971. Know your history, heads. Now, I can't even pretend to sit here and say how this year is all that different from the 420s in the past few years, because it's really not. Everything Bake Nation is all about is actually being legally mandated by the federal government right about now. Think about it. There's not a more willing group of people in the entire world who are happy to stay home, watch movies, and order delivery than heads, than stoners. That's not some kind of sacrifice. It's a sacrifice for the rest of us, but to them, it's a dream day. It's their best day ever. And it comes at a perfect time, because right now on April 20th, 2020, the ganja is now legal in 47 different states. And all weed shops have been deemed an essential business. Man, how you like that, Team Bake? You want to talk about flipping the script. Weed shops, first of all, there are weed shops. Second of all, they are deemed essential. You want to talk about flipping the script. It's not that long ago that the feds would bust into a feed shop or a grow operation, seize everything, and lock everybody up. Now those very same outfits are not only being broken up, they're being protected by law. And you're being told to stay home and fire up the volcano vaporizer. I think Charlie Sheen coined a word for that.
Winning.
So not only is the law on your side, practically everybody else is as well. From Tommy Chong to even Jocko Willink. American badass Jocko tweeted a pic of his watch at 4:20 this morning and captioned it, "Time to smoke some burpees." And so even a former SEAL is in on it. Well, not really, because then if you looked at the video that he tweeted out, he made a point of saying, "I'm not smoking. I have friends who do. The only thing I'm smoking are 420 burpees." Jocko ain't playing. So the SEALs are in, although their idea of smoking on 420 is very different than yours and Tommy Chong's. Tommy Chong told ABC News his plans for today, and they sound pretty awesome. Quote, "You know, wake up, mosey on downstairs for breakfast, then find a place to have a nap, then wait for 420, get on Instagram, and smoke with my fans," end quote. When the hardest part of your day is eating breakfast, then your name is Logan Rome. Seriously, Logan. Get up, man.
Rogan Low.
When the hardest part of your day is eating breakfast and you've already slept twice before lunch, you're officially living the life. Speaking of living the life, here's another face of Bake Nation. Who doesn't love Seth Rogen? Dude's genius, right? He's brilliant. He tells Jimmy Kimmel last night, or told him last night, exactly what he has been up to in quarantine.
"I've smoked a truly ungodly amount of weed in the time that I've been quarantined. More than normal. Yeah, thank God it's been declared an essential service, because that, I would describe it as essential."
No way. No way. The writer of Pineapple Express has been ripping, quote, "a truly ungodly amount of weed," end quote, while in quarantine. Like I said, stoners were meant for this. Stoners were built for this. Stoners were put on earth for this. This is the life that they've been living long before we were told we had to live this life. Like, I've had them in the back of my mind. I wonder how many people were really mentally and physically and prepared for what we're dealing with right now. Really. Stoners were. And yes, there are a ton of 420 festivals that have been canceled today, like the one on Hippie Hill in San Francisco. But it is 2020 and not 1920. So guys like Tommy Chong and Snoop Dogg and Be Real from Cypress Hill are all hosting smoke-ins on Zoom today. That's right. Instead of that typical 420 smoke-out that takes place across the country, there are dozens of Zoom smoke-ins instead. And again, find me a head who is not thrilled that instead of having to throw on a poncho, back comb the dreads, and ride a longboard down to Golden Gate Park and see people there, that would not rather instead stay at home, fire up the lapper, and get their work done right where they are. Let's just hope that the neighbors paid the internet bill and still are not password protecting the Wi-Fi. In spite of every negative thing happening in the world right now, this is potentially the very best 420 ever for Team Bake. Weed has been deemed essential. It is legal. It is available by delivery. The government is forcing Bake Nation to stay home. Spotify and Netflix have them covered for stoner jams and stoner movies. Speaking of which, if I'm going to take all this time and hype your high holiday when I don't even partake, and I don't at all, you better return the favor and make a phone call. I mean, I want to know, how are you celebrating? What's it like? This has always been a source of curiosity for me, how you do something differently than you do every single day. That's what I'm asking you. How is today? It's a little bit tougher to ask that question because all of our days are the same now and they're all running together. But for all you heads to do this anyway, how is 420 day any different than any other day? Hit me up. I'm curious. Are you blasting Sublime? Or are you blasting Afro Man?
I was gonna go to class before I got high. Come on, y'all.
Or are you watching Half Baked?
Yo, who's on munchies tonight, yo?
What do you guys want?
Get some sour cream and onion chips with some dip, man. Some beef jerky, some peanut butter. Get some Häagen-Dazs ice cream bars, a whole lot of hot. Make sure it's chocolate. Gotta have chocolate, man. Some popcorn, red popcorn, graham crackers. Graham crackers with the marshmallows and little chocolate bars. We'll make some s'mores, man.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, yo.
Also, celery, grape jelly, Captain Crunch with the little crunch berries. Pizzas. We need two big pizzas, man. Everything on them with water, a whole lot of water.
That, are you watching that, or are you just going to go with Super Troopers instead?
Littering and smoking the reefer. Now, to teach you boys a lesson, Officer Rabbit and I are going to stand here while you three smoke the whole bag.
And again, I am not fully steeped in Kron culture, but I know that it's a Kron Christmas. It's Stoner Christmas. So on a day like today, do you break out your finest china? Is there some piece that you only break out for 420? Put simply, what makes today different than every other day? And can you top Matt in California from 420-2017?
Woke up with no alarm clock. Didn't have one of those. Didn't need it. Had breakfast where I wanted it. Went right to the big, we might call it a stash, but it's a big bin of something that I like to do. And I pull that off the tree and I break it up in big handfuls, and then that's what I do. Right now, I am rifling through my kids' Easter basket. Both my kids.
That's incredible.
Just the good stuff, though. Just the, like, jelly beans and some caramel things.
Right, so how do you explain that? When they come home and they're looking for that Easter basket and there's nothing in it, and they're like, Dad, did you get high and eat all my candy? What's your response going to be?
Rome, I do what any good Catholic man would do. I look them dead in the face and I lie. I say, I have no idea where your candy is, kids, and then I go to confession.
Now, if you can do that half as well as Matt, if you have half of that in you, I want to hear from you next segment. Let's go to New Orleans. Nooch in New Orleans. Happy Stoner Christmas, Nooch. What's up?
Hey, man. Thank you for the lush, super green vine, Romy. Look, man, as the most notorious stoner in the jungle, I feel today is my obligation to give props to the second most notorious stoner in the jungle, Adam Hawk. Hawk's probably the only stoner that I know that still hides nugs of reef under his bed like Kits used to hide nudie magazines. Meanwhile, I'm smoking blunts the size of beds. Hawk doesn't really comprehend how the slide bowl on his bong works. Meanwhile, I have an entire line of bongs named after me. Hawk thinks it's fun to take his little $30 vape pen down to his Prius. He calls that stuff hotboxing. I hotbox the French Quarter so damn hard, Romy, that the New Orleans Fire Department has an official Nooch alarm. Now, Rome, I'm not here just to destroy your EP today. Today's a celebration, man, togetherness and joy. You know, but I know Hawk is still kind of frustrated because he had to buy that big, giant, fake bag of the CBD herb. But Hawk, bro, listen, I had to do it. Man, you can barely be trusted to brush your teeth in the morning without the serious threat of choking to death. In fact, I bet you a bright, blue, bubbling bong that you couldn't even tie your damn shoes if your wife hadn't inked instructions on the top of your stupid foot. Anyway, Rome, I'm done throwing smoke at your producer. I've got, you know, another kind of smoke to throw. But my last thought is this. For all of you closet stoners out there, today is the day to be yourself. Don't be like Hawk. Do better. I'm out.
Nooch. All right, Adam. You deserve a chance to respond. Unless you're too high. All right, let's try PDX. Cameron in the PDX. I bet he's got a better answer. Good to have you, Cameron.
Hey, Romy, what's up, man?
What's up?
I'm a longtime listener, and I just appreciate you always having Team Bakes back, man. That's awesome. And I'm of the professional class of Team Bakes, so I had to do a little planning. So I'm at work. So last night, I get the start, and I go, I got to trust you that you're not on Team Bakes. I got to take your word for it. But I went level 10 on the edibles last night. And when you go level 10 on the edibles, you wake up in a weed coma. And so that's going to get me through about the first 4 hours of work. Total mental abyss. And then I got a nice little cartridge for when I get home, a little live resin. So it's basically just, you know, same as usual. Just dial it up to level 10.
Wow, dude, that's serious. All right, so he went level 10 on edibles the night before, which meant that he woke up in a weed coma. And he figures he'll still be lit for another 4 hours. They don't get home, find the cartridge, and fire it up again. Sounds exhausting, man. All right, so I said, what's different about today, if you're partaking? Let's go to Idaho. Ray in Idaho. Hey, Ray, how are you?
Jim, how's it going, man?
Good,
big
dude.
Fan,
how you doing?
Long-time listener, first caller. Today is different, man. It's the fourth month of the year on 2020. Just think, we're never going to have this day again in history. And for all of us potheads that are able to light up on this day, it's just super exciting. Already hit the dispensary. Got some THCA, pure crystals, got a brand new pipe, and just going all out for this one.
So, bro, what's the rest of the day look like?
The rest of the day looks like just headed home. Actually, just talked to my brother in France. We used to watch this movie called Dead Man on Campus, and I'm just going to go and watch that and try to enjoy the day, man.
Right on. How's your bro doing?
Pretty good. I mean, they're locked down over there in Paris, but he was able to get some stuff from Amsterdam, and they're partaking too, so it's awesome.
Right on. Well, listen, bro, happy 420, and you make a good point. It is the fourth month, and it is the 20th day, and it is the 2020 year. Wow. Let's go to Colorado Springs. Stony Tony. Stony Tony, what's up, dude?
I'm a long-time listener, a great big fan of yours, bro. Anyway, how we do it different, I grew up in Hawaii in the 70s. I'm 59 years old. And yes, brother, I wake and I bake.
Tony, I'm sorry I missed that. Say that one more time. You what?
I get up. I'm 59 years old. I grew up in Hawaii in the 60s and 70s. And when I went to school, my twin sister was known as Mary Lude. So how did I get the name Stony Tony? Go figure, right? But anyway, how we do it different now that I live in Colorado, and it's legal up here. And like you said earlier, it's 40. How many states are legal now?
47.
This is the greatest thing America could have done, because we're all doing it illegal. We're all getting in trouble for it. But now we're doing it a lot different.
How is it different? It's legal?
How? It's legal, bro. We don't have to hide it. I can sit on my front porch now, and I can light up and tell the neighborhood, hey, I hope you like this smell. Or in the place that I live in, Colorado Springs, on an average time of the evening when everybody come home from work and everybody want to chill a little bit, exactly what they do. You smell it throughout the whole neighborhood. They all burn.
It's a great time to be alive. My man, Stony Tony, good looking out. Say hi to Mary Lude for me. So the moral of this story is, today is no different than any other day, just as I suspected. We are joined by Jared Pinkney. Jared, I do want to talk about the draft, and I want to talk about your time at Vandy. But before we do that, how are you and your family doing in the middle of the coronavirus?
Hey, thanks for having me. But yeah, we're doing all right. I just came back about 2 days ago. Got to spend some time with everybody, so everybody's healthy and we're good.
Good, good, good to hear it, and it's good to have you on. So I've talked to a number of draft prospects and current pros in the last few weeks. We've talked about how challenging it is to get your work in, to do your workouts, to stay in shape with gyms and other facilities closed. How are you staying in shape these days?
Well, that's actually a pretty funny story because I went out running about an hour and a half ago, and what I'll do is I'll put my headphones on and play music and run to a song, and I'll run at a moderate pace for as long as the song goes, and then I'll get about a 10 to 15 second rest afterwards in between the next song starting. But I might have to rethink that because the song called Welcome to Houston came on, and if anybody knows anything about that song, it's ridiculously long. So I've really got in trouble with that.
So you got some good work in, though, man.
Yeah.
Now, you be careful what you put in your phone. Now, you had a huge junior season. You could have entered the draft last year. I think a number of people who were in your shoes, or if they were in your shoes, would have done just that. What was your decision-making process like, and ultimately, what brought you back to Vanderbilt?
Well, the thing about it was I felt like there were things that I hadn't accomplished yet, individually and just as a team. And one of those things, obviously, was to graduate, and I was able to do that in December. And then another was, you know, go to a bigger and better bowl game and just do things that Vanderbilt players and teams haven't done in the past.
Jared Pinkney's my guest. Now, the thing about the degree, which is really interesting to me, you said this, when I see the degree and I see the opportunities I'm going to have in football, for me to have done that at the same time, I feel like that's a huge accomplishment, end quote. Now, you could have left, you could have come back later when your football career was over and finish up the degree. So why was it important to finish both at the same time?
I think it just presents a unique advantage and opportunity for guys like us, because at Vanderbilt, and you kind of see it in the NFL, the guys that go, they're kind of undervalued and they end up sticking on and staying on rosters. And we had guys on both Super Bowl rosters, and we've had guys that are starting in the NFL, and it speaks to our versatility and our ability to adapt under adverse situations and things like that, because we're competing against the best athletes on Saturday and then also the best students in the classroom in the country on every other day.
I happen to agree with you, especially with that school. That's an excellent, excellent school. So when you go back to when you were being recruited, what was it about Vanderbilt that appealed to you the most? Why was that the best fit?
Coach Mason was probably number one on the list, because the thing that I always tell people when they ask me about him is while he obviously cares about making you as good as a football player as you can be, his main concern is sending you back a better man than your parents dropped you off. And I absolutely believe that he did that with me, and my mom can speak to that. And, you know, it's just, he's an amazing guy, and I owe probably 90% of my success to him.
We're talking about Derek Mason. He also said of you, quote, he's an old soul in a young man's body. He is one of the hardest workers you'll find on and off the field. What about that old soul thing? Like, where does the approach come from? Did you just kind of, were you wired for that? Was that the way you always were? Or is that an approach that you developed?
No, it's the way I always was, but I got a little bit of better direction once I got older, because I was able to see, you know, former players, coaches, you know, even teammates, how they would go about their work. And, you know, even Mason, to a certain degree, he kind of teach me, you know, certain ways that I could be more productive in approaching my work. And, I mean, I guess the main guy is Jerry Rice, because when you talk about Jerry Rice, the first thing you think of is hard work. And he kind of gave you a cheat sheet for him being arguably the greatest football player of all time. He accomplished that through hard work.
So, Jerry, what about that cheat sheet? I mean, were there specific things on that cheat sheet other than him running that hill? What did you get from him? What did you pick up from Jerry Rice and watching his approach?
The route running, like the attention to detail that he has in the route running is something I really, really want to hone in on once I get to the NFL. And even now, because, you know, during this time, there are things that you can do instead of just, you know, running and running and running. You can get the mental aspect too. But his attention to detail with the routes and his intelligence in terms of identifying coverages and things like that.
Jared Pinkney is joining us. We're getting ready for the draft. It's coming up on Thursday. Now, you had that huge junior season, and then your senior year didn't go quite the way you or anybody else would have liked on offense, as things never really clicked. But as you look back on last season, what kind of thoughts do you have?
It's unfortunate that it wasn't able to click, you know, because with us the years before, and mainly the year, my junior year, they were guys that I'd grown up with for 4 years. It was my entire class. And mainly, I think it was only two or three of us that actually redshirted. So everybody was in their last year, no matter what. And we were able to build off of the chemistry that we've been building for 4 years, you know, on and off the field, in each other's dorm rooms, playing video games and going out on the town on the weekends and stuff like that. And it manifested into wins and production on the fields on Saturday.
Now, it seems to me it would be really easy to get angry or be frustrated about that. But at the Combine, you said, quote, "I think it was an important lesson in not only my football development, but life," end quote. So how were you able to go about approaching it as a learning opportunity? And then what did you learn from that situation?
Yeah, definitely, because in life, everything's not going to go exactly the way you want it. You're going to find adversity at some point, and you got to be able to respond to that, you know, because I took it as, all right, when I'm 35, 40 years old and something happens with my kids, you know, I can't just shut down and be like, oh, my God, like, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. What am I going to do? I got to be able to respond and take care of them to the best of my ability, you know, in my marriage or, you know, just friends and little things like that. But even the big things, like I said, with marriage and children, you can take lessons from football and especially this year that I just had and apply it to that and end up being a better man.
Like I said, man, old soul. Jared Pinkney joining us. That's a great take. Now, when you were at the Senior Bowl in January, you made the point that, quote, tight end is the most undervalued position in sports, end quote. When you look at the fact that some of the biggest weapons in the game play at that position, it does make sense. But lay it out for me. What do you mean by that? Why is that the most undervalued position in all of sports?
Well, if you think about it, it's very, very, very similar to linebacker. When you think of all the things that you want from a good tight end and all the things that you'd require. If you're building one in a lab, you want it to be fast, you want to be big, you want to be quick and agile, but you also want to be highly intelligent, be able to recognize coverages, while also retain information in the pass and run game in terms of fronts and stunts and things like that. He's got to be able to block, strong enough to block, good enough footwork to block, run game and pass pro, his patience, and then his footwork in the pass pro in his sets and things like that. And then his routes, he's got to be able to catch. He's got to be able to sit his hips down and come in and out of breaks. And then he's got to be able to elevate over a guy or run through a guy after the catch. There's so many things.
Jared Pinkney joining us. There are so many things. And so many guys playing the game at a high level right now, playing that position at a high level. Who are some of the tight ends that you like to study and learn from?
I actually like to watch them all. And that's kind of a weird answer, I know. But I watch the Kittles and Kelsey's, you know, at the top. All the way down to, like, I mean, not down because they're not bad players, but the guys who don't get as much recognition as, like, a Foster Moreau who came out last year or 2 years ago. No, it was last year. And then, like, a Lee Smith. And I know our games are totally different, but, you know, it's good to watch guys that are able to have success in different ways. And I hate watching George Kittle because he's just a freaky athlete. He explodes through and runs past everybody. It's hard to watch him because I can't translate that to my game.
All right. In terms of translation and adjustments, you had a great line about when you get into the NFL. You said, quote, "You have to physically adjust to hitting grown men, 30-year-olds with mortgages as opposed to the 19-year-old who was just late to study hall." Like, how do you go about making or preparing to make that adjustment?
I think you got to put it in a perspective of, eventually, you're going to be that 30-year-old man that's got a mortgage. And, you know, if they can do it, then there's no reason that you can't do it. And, you know, it's really a mindset, a dominant mindset of being at the will to win and being able to take yourself there mentally, physically, and relying and trusting on your training and preparation.
So, Jared, it seems to me you and I have talked now for about 10 minutes. You've got all the right answers. And I bring this up because you tell a great story from your time at the Combine when you were talking to the Patriots. And you said it's interesting because with a team that's been winning for as long as they have, you expect them to come in with a certain mentality and to share that mentality and to spread it and impart it on you. And that's exactly what happened. I gave kind of a wonky answer and it was like, no, that's a loser's mentality, quote, end of quote. What do you remember about that conversation? And what was it you said that inspired them to say to you, that's a loser's mentality?
Yeah, the crazy thing about it was, like, we had a great conversation the entire time. It was just the one answer that I gave to their one question. And it was about pass protection. Because, I mean, I'm obviously not tackled, so I know I have room to improve in that area. But I think it was somewhere along the lines of, I'm not going to throw any names out there, but they named a highly productive guy. It was like, okay, what if your task was blocking him? What are you going to do? And I basically said, well, I got to eat my Wheaties because, you know, he's a tough guy. I'm going to have to get in the weight room and blah, blah, blah. Basically avoiding actually answering the question of how you're going to beat this guy that's all pro. And they're like, no. That's a loser's mentality. And then they helped me correct it, and I just absorbed the knowledge.
Now, I wonder, though, like, I'm looking at it, I mean, maybe, I guess, I'm looking at it from a different point of view. You go to Vanderbilt, you're playing SEC football at an elite level, so to me, you're about as far from a loser as you can get. So what was your reaction when they said that to you?
I didn't take it personally because, again, they weren't calling me a loser or saying I had a loser mentality. They were just saying my answer was that of a loser's mentality.
Good night now!